stunned silence.
Oh, yes.
A bit of an episode, right?
So it must be doing something, right?
And it's playing or something.
Tell us what you mean.
I just can't
figure it
out.
I love the enthusiasm.
Cool. You're tuned to the 15th Station, New Zealand's first Catholic podcast. This is episode 143 for October 2019. I'm your host, James, and in the virtual rendition studios, we welcome back Gavin. How are you, Gavin?
Good, thanks, James. Nice to talk to you. Feels like it's been a month or so.
It does feel like it's been at least 4 weeks. It's always good to talk to you, mate. It's always wonderful to talk to Anna. How are you, Anna?
I'm good, thank you very much. Yeah,
brilliant.
I think it's been less than a month, actually.
We did see you in the flesh.
That's true. You did when you came over to Auckland town. It was good to see you both. Albeit somewhat fleetingly, Anna.
Yes, true.
and the Don, how are you, mate?
I'm good. Was that?
It was good to have you there as well. We could have done a live Station 15 recording, but it would have been like Station 3 or something. So whenever it was on what day of the month when you guys were over here, but it was great to see you both.
Mm. Yeah, no, it was good to be home. See some fine New Zealand folks.
That's right.
We're actually back at a time of when the church was in the news, as we're probably about to talk about.
We've got a pretty intensive lineup tonight. Some big stories. Let's start straight into it. We're going to this first one from Radio New Zealand, although we could have taken it from a number of sources. The Pope has accepted the resignation of the Bishop of Palmerston North, Charles Drennan, following an investigation into a complaint of unacceptable behaviour of a sexual nature. The Metropolitan Archbishop of New Zealand, Cardinal John Dew, said in the eyes of the Catholic Church, Bishop Drennan's behaviour was completely unacceptable. The complaint was made by a young woman and the bishop tendered his resignation to Pope Francis. The Pope's decision was announced by the Vatican at 11 o'clock on Friday, the Friday before. In a news release, Cardinal Dew said upon receiving the complaint, the New Zealand Church's independent investigation body, the National Office of Professional Standards, brought in an independent, licensed investigator under his oversight. The Cardinal said Bishop Drennan stood aside from his duties and both he and the young woman participated in the investigation. The young woman has been informed of his resignation and the church is in ongoing contact with her, Cardinal Dew said. The church was committed to giving continuing support to the young woman, her family and those around her. Quote, the young woman has requested that details of the complaint remain private, said Cardinal Dew. In the eyes of the Catholic Church, Bishop Drennan's behaviour was completely unacceptable and it fully supports the young woman for coming forward to NOPS, which is the National Office for Professional Standards. This was a bit of a bombshell, Gavin, in terms of this news when it dropped, and there was obviously covered in the mainstream media, and then there was a letter read out in parishes around the country. So, what did you make of this quite shocking news?
Yeah, well, it was shocking in many definitions of the word, among other things, the fact that the investigation was able to be conducted essentially in secret. And I don't mean that in a sort of covert, churches covering up way, but just that, investigations of this nature should be able to be conducted with a level of secrecy and privacy, but that there wasn't a leak to the media is what I mean by secrecy, I guess, that a story of this import was essentially under wraps until a few hours before it was announced, and when it was leaked, and I'm not sure if anyone's got to the bottom of why it was leaked a few hours early, there was a lack of clarity around what the resignation would be about. I heard some news earlier that evening saying, oh, it was going to be for health reasons. So when it was finally announced, it was like I was confused. I didn't realise that he'd been unwell, and then became clear that it wasn't actually for health reasons that he was resigning. I guess a few reflections, one of which would be that it does demonstrate, and Peter Lynham, who we've often cited on the show, is one of the foremost religious historians in New Zealand, saying that the church moved quickly and conducted a process independently and came to this conclusion, and commended the church for that. It is important that the church investigate some where things are found to be lacking or where there's been sins that have taken place, and in this case not criminal, but were obviously sins against a priest, let alone a bishop's promise for celibacy, where that's taken place, it's important that it is investigated. And in the case of a bishop, given all that's going on in the church in recent history, for something to happen so swiftly, I guess in some ways is a sense of relief. I hope that it's something of a harbinger of how the Church and the Vatican will proceed on these matters in the future. Too often the Church has been far too slow to move on different matters, whether it relates to adult or abuse against children. So I guess if we were looking for a silver lining in what's a very dark cloud, it might be that this is a part of a turning over of a new leaf. You know, the Pope issued a new motu proprio back in May that was designed to try and make the Church's response more speedy and more authentic. So this might be an indication that that's what we might expect under these new norms.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's a fair summary. Although a couple of things that I've kind of heard subsequently in terms of there's a couple of complainants, and that while again none of the accusations, as I understand it, are criminal, which everyone kind of is dancing around. For me, that obviously feels like the reality is he's broken his vow of celibacy, and what the point is that the parties were willing participants to some extent, to enough of extent where there isn't a concern of an allegation of criminal behavior. But Anna, it does sort of, you know, this idea of, you know, turning of a new leaf and the Church responding, and I mean, you know, got all this coverage and it wasn't like the Church wasn't on the front foot, if you like. But this didn't happen yesterday. So, you know, my understanding was we're talking months of investigation and the bishop stood aside from his duty. So that was what I'm trying to think, when he stood aside, that was like right back at the beginning of the year, I think. What was your sort of take on the run of events and the announcement?
Incredibly disappointed and saddened, I suppose. And he's someone I know reasonably well. And I guess the thing is that it's a reminder that we're all sinners, right? And even if one is a bishop and has perhaps demonstrated in other areas, you know, like good competence, I suppose. We always fall short, and that was a big falling short, I believe, his actions. I guess for the most part, I was pretty gobsmacked. I couldn't talk about it for the first. Well, no, it wasn't. I couldn't talk about it. I just felt like it took a while to process, I think, this whole thing. So, I mean, as Gavin said, like, you know, the fact that this process has happened and like the investigation happened, it is great. And it happened as far as we're aware, that the first time someone complained about it, there was an investigation launched. So if that is definitely the case, then that's good. That's what should be happening. Whether there's going to be more complainants who come forward, I wouldn't be surprised if that happens, because sort of the nature of, well, we already know that there's at least one other, right, that has come forward. So, but it is, it's disappointing, the whole saga. But I was reflecting today about, this, like the sins of against our the vows that we make, like whether you're married or ordained or whatever, and how, while that's very grave and something that needs to be repented of and changed in one's behaviour, but there is, like, I was sort of thinking that while perhaps he may always remain, maybe he remains a bishop, maybe he's laicized, I'm not sure what the process will be now for him, and what the Church will demand, but if he does remain a cleric, at least, there is still hope that he can learn to live his vow of celibacy. And I hope he does, I pray that he does learn that. Because that's what is fruitful, right? Is the living of that, and perhaps even turning away from the sin in his past and being able to change his behavior. And anyway, we'll see.
We will indeed. Don, what about you, mate? What did you make of this news? You obviously would have heard it, I'm sure, before tonight's recording. What did you make of the announcement?
It is sad. I guess, although it's not criminal if you take it from a secular perspective, it is a person in a pretty high position having sexual relations with someone in a less high position. So if you take it, say, in the context of, say, law, it's like a partner sleeping with one of the interns. But again, just to reiterate some of Anna's points, it does show that no matter where we are, we are still all sinners as well. And we should pray for the victim and for the bishop and for the church. It is great that the church has gone through this process pretty quickly, there seems to be accountability in this process and an outcome which seems pretty satisfactory given what we know of the circumstances.
Yeah, and I have the feeling there's going to be more to come on this, but I do agree generally with the sentiment. I mean, I was quite I was very shocked, as I'm sure many were. I don't think anyone was expecting this, initially, I have to say that when I heard the first headline, and I think Gavin, you alluded to the slightly early release, and I was left going, "Oh, please don't be an abuse case." Obviously, in terms of the limited facts that we do know, it doesn't seem to be that way. With the caveat being your point, Don, around the abuse of power or authority, but at least it isn't some of what was seen around the rest of the world. But it is a reminder, as you say, that we're a church of sinners. So, we should pray for all of the church and all of the clergy. And I include, Bishop Drennan in that. I mean, he is still a bishop at the moment. That's my understanding, right? They haven't, they've got an ongoing investigation, but he's resigned. So, he's resigned as a bishop.
Still a bishop. Yeah, he's resigned as the ordinary bishop, as in, that's the technical term, the ordinary of Palmerston North.
Right.
He hasn't resigned as a bishop. And in the interviews that I saw with Cardinal Dew in the aftermath, I think he was unclear quite how the process would unfold from here.
Right.
It would be a situation, I think, for Pope Francis and or the Congregation for Bishops rather than for Bishop Drennan or for Cardinal Dew, is what I understand.
Right. Well, we will continue to follow it on the 15th station, and we'll sort of see what happens in the coming weeks and months, I guess, in about 4 weeks, in fact. And the next our next story is on a far more positive note. This is from Reuters. Pope Francis declared 5 people saints, including Cardinal John Henry Newman, a leading 19th century Anglican who converted to Catholicism and became one of the most influential Christian figures of modern times. Underscoring Newman's luminary status in Christianity today, Prince Charles, who will become head of the Church of England when he becomes king, attended the canonization mass in St. Peter's Square and said it was a cause for celebration by all Britons. Quote, "Whatever our own beliefs, and no matter what our own tradition may be, we can only be grateful to Newman for the gifts rooted in his Catholic faith which he shared with wider society," Charles said in an article in the Vatican newspaper. Charles praised Newman, the first British saint in more than 40 years, and the first Englishman born since the 1600s to be canonized, as, quote, "this great Briton, this great churchman, and, as we can now say, this great saint." In 1833, just 8 years after he was ordained an Anglican priest, Newman helped launch the Oxford Movement that aimed to return the Church of England, which split with Rome in 1534, to the teachings and rituals of early Christianity. He was the movement's chief promoter and became increasingly critical of certain Anglican teachings and was opposed to a national church with no links to Rome. He converted to Catholicism in 1845, was ordained a Catholic priest in 1847, and was elevated to the rank of cardinal in 1879. The Pope also canonized three nuns, and I apologize in advance for the pronunciation. Giuseppina Vanini, who was 1859 to 1911, an Italian who founded a religious order. Mariam Teresa Chirumal Mankandayan, 1876 to 1926, an Indian who helped the poor. And Dolce Lopez Pontes, 1914 to 1992, a Brazilian who dedicated much of her life to educating workers. He also canonized Marguerite Bays, who was 1815 to 1879, a Swiss laywoman who is said to have the stigmata, the five wounds of the crucified Jesus. This is always good, isn't it, Anna, when we hear that we've got some new saints officially added to the communion of saints, but quite big news, Cardinal John Henry Newman becoming, sorry, Saint John Henry Newman, wouldn't you think?
Well, indeed. I mean, he's a very popular writer and thinker, like still currently, you know, his works are very relevant to perhaps our particular times as well. And so because he's popular in the first place, you know, this is it is a big deal for him to be canonized. So it's actually a good impetus to read more of his stuff and perhaps sort of understand what he was trying to do a little bit more.
What did you make, Don, of Prince Charles there, right? Making some positive comments. It's quite a big thing to say for the future head of the Church of England.
It is, and it is quite strange, because if you go into some of Cardinal or Saint Newman's quotes, he does say stuff like, to be deep in history is to cease to be a Protestant. And other quotes like, what attracted them to the church, is really around the teaching and how our church has the ability to not obfuscate or confuse or dilute church teaching. And that's really what he was seeing in the Anglican church and what attracted him to the Catholic church. I mean, he spent a lot of time trying to reconcile the two, but in the end, he could not, and his only option was to convert to Catholicism. So on two fronts, I'm a little bit surprised. One, that the Anglicans and that Prince Charles did attend and do kind of venerate him, given his kind of shaded intellectual attacks on Anglicanism. And also I'm surprised that Pope Francis, given his choices of cardinals and how he himself obfuscates and dilutes church teachings, has chosen to promote this person to sainthood. And I guess I'm confused from that. So I guess the church works in mysterious ways.
Well, you have to get a dig in there, don't you, Dan? Look, I mean, when you talk about... I was wondering what I was waiting for it. I mean, Gavin, I don't know how much the Pope chooses to elevate the saints, isn't the point that it's a process which is then he confirms that they're saints. But I take Don's point. What about these the three nuns that were also canonized? I mean, that's fantastic, especially when I think historically there's been a lot of, well, not a lot of, there's been some critique from people who don't study these things closely about the somewhat gender imbalanced position of recognized canonized saints. But it's great to
Can you repeat the names for me?
No.
Oh, just joking.
Mariam and Dolce.
And the laywoman too, don't forget.
And the laywoman, sorry, Marguerite. Very good point. Thank you, Anna. Great call out. So it's actually three nuns and a laywoman. That's 4-1 in terms of this canonization cycle.
Yeah, it's interesting. Obviously we can't go back and find out. But well, we probably could do some analysis. But I wonder if in the other countries from where these female saints came, if it'd be a bit like this in reverse. Oh, so-and-so was canonized. Oh, by the way, some English guy was canonized as well, which has sort of been the way that in the English-speaking world, because Newman being an English speaker and some of the historical situation around, no Englishman born after, since the 1600s or whatever has been, or English person since the 1600s has been canonized, and then first Britain canonized in decades. There's lots of other things that go with it, but I think the fact that we live in an Anglophone country means that we're more inclined to hear about Newman, and unfortunately, I guess, not learn so much about these other fine and holy women who have now been elevated to the official list of saints canonized in the church. I must admit that I haven't studied up on them closely enough. Often you look at the saints of the day and there are sometimes, you know, dozens on a particular day, dozens minus one of whom you've never heard of. You might have heard of a particular saint on a, you know, October 4th is St. Francis of Assisi, and there's probably, you know, a few dozen other saints on that day that we've never heard of. And maybe we need to have a project to try and learn about an obscure saint who can be a model for us. So maybe that's my homework for the next 4 weeks.
There you go. That's your homework for the next 4 weeks.
Learn about Dolce. I'll learn about Dolce.
Dolce. So, good on you. I expect a report back ahead of our next episode. But this is, yeah, I mean, I think it's always great to hear about a variety of men and women who are saints. It's always good. I mean, that's the whole point, right, of these people being role models for us, and all of them human, all of them, you know, sinners like the rest of us, and yet they are now very much in heaven. We have the confidence to know that, and therefore able to, you know, pray for us. And we ask them all to pray for us, to pray for this podcast, pray for everyone who's listening on this podcast as well. That'll be fantastic. Let's switch to the Catholic News Service. This is talking about coming from the Synod. Most bishops who lead dioceses in the Amazon support the ordination of married men of proven virtue, or the viri probati, as a way of addressing the lack of priests in the region, a Brazilian bishop said. Speaking to journalists after a Vatican press briefing yesterday, retired Bishop Erwin Krautler of Zingu said, "I guess that of the bishops who are in the Amazon region, two-thirds are in favour of the viri probati." Several bishops and other speakers at the Synod of Bishops for the Amazon proposed the ordination of married men, preferably elders in their respective communities, as a solution for remote communities that often go from 1 month to up to 1 year without the celebration of the Eucharist. During the Synod's morning session on the 8th of October, the Vatican said several bishops proposed the ordination of married viri probati, and at least one suggested the Church could evaluate over time whether this experience is valid or not. At the briefing, Bishop Krautler said that when it comes to ordaining married men of proven virtue, there is no other option. Quote, "The indigenous people don't understand celibacy. They say that very openly, and I see it," the bishop said. "When I go to an indigenous village, the first thing they ask is, 'Where is your wife?' And I tell them, 'I don't have one.' Then they look at me with pity." Bishop Krautler added that there are thousands of indigenous communities in the Amazon that do not celebrate the Eucharist except perhaps one, two, or three times a year. "The Eucharist for us Catholics is the source and summit of our faith, and these poor people are practically excluded from the context of the Catholic Church," he said. Well, Don, and it's interesting in the context of some of the first story we're talking about tonight, but what did you make of this? I mean, there's obviously quite a bit of news in and around the Synod of the Bishops of the Amazon. But in particularly this topic, what do you make of what the bishops there are saying about the viri probati?
To take a quote from Star Wars, it's a trap. Basically, it's the thin end of the wedge in terms of making an excuse to try to have ordained married priests. I mean, we have ordained married priests in extraordinary circumstances where they've already been married and come in from the high Anglican Church. But it's not, and it should never be an option for the everyday, and them trying to make an exception because of this Amazon situation seems ridiculous. And since when have we basically been a religion that goes, we're there to teach our religion or bring our religion to the Amazonian people, and the idea that we can't find priests from elsewhere to fill those gaps or find another solution so that these people can receive communion, and the idea that we can't basically or they wouldn't understand our approach to celibacy eventually, given months of dialogue, just seems very strange and a little ridiculous.
All right, I'll take the bait. Didn't we, for basically half the church's history, have married priests? Wasn't it until the Council of Trent in 1100 or whatever it was, where, or 1200, or when the law was changed?
Trent was 15 something.
15, yeah. Was it Trent or was it before Trent?
It was before Trent. So right. Celibacy was 11th century, I think, 11th or 12th.
Right. So about halfway along the journey of the Catholic Church, Gavin. So in that situation, wouldn't we, like, we have talked about this. There's a big difference between. I get a little bit frustrated when we conflate the issues of married priests and female priests. That's quite a very, very different situation. But in the manner of this, especially this very probati, I mean, not to sort of plug a hole in the Amazonian challenge of having enough priests, but I mean, it has been a legitimate part of church history for more than 1,000 years, Don.
I'll go back and do a little bit more prep on this because I'm
okay, Gavin. All right,
I am under prep, but my understanding is that it has been a tradition from day one, and it's only liberals have basically made it a modern type thing. If you look at the example of go back to the disciples. Yes, some of them were, I understand, married at the time, but they did basically make themselves celibate as soon as they decided to basically follow Jesus and become the first bishops. So the idea that is a modern invention to be celibate and abstain from marital relations is ridiculous when you go back down time. Yeah, just go back to the time of Jesus.
Okay, Gavin. All right, mediate. Even though I'm supposed to be the mediator, mediate here. And what do you make of this? And actually, where the conversation's gone?
Well, yeah. I mean, it is a very complicated history, and Anna probably even knows better the history of celibacy than I do, and the church. But essentially, yes, for more than 1,000 years. The priesthood as we know it now allowed priests to be married. Now I would, it's interesting Don used the term, I think it was everyday, an everyday situation. In terms of the Amazon situation, I think is clearly outside what you would call the everyday situation. I do agree, and I reflect on, we've reflected on this issue a lot, that we talk about, the priest shortage in New Zealand or the priest shortage in Australia. A little bit like we talk about, we're so persecuted in Australia or so persecuted in New Zealand. When you really get a sense of how the church and our fellow Catholics live in other countries, to think that you might receive communion once a year in certain places in the Amazon, I think that more priests could be sent from different parts of the world there, and that New Zealand and Australia and lots of other countries could survive with fewer priests when we look at the church as a global institution and when a mission is to evangelize and to go out and to help people live a Catholic life. So it's not a cleanest solution, but I've often wondered about the diaconate and whether the diaconate could be expanded in a way that allows it. So, whether it's the delivery of communion into those communities or there's been people who've talked about whether deacons ought to be able to celebrate Mass. Again, it's probably getting into the same debate about, do you allow married clergy or do you allow deacons to celebrate Mass, or exceptions to existing norms and rules. But I struggle to accept the fact that people who can only receive communion once a year is a situation that we don't try to find a solution to. And there are three that have that I've just sort of mentioned: more priests from around the world, whether it's very probative, whether it's deacons who can celebrate the Eucharist. There are no doubt thousands of others, one of which many would say would be women priests, but
it's not,
share that view.
I won't take the bait on that one. But Anna, I mean, you definitely are the most informed on this of the people on this podcast, for sure. If I think historical, my very you know, limited knowledge from of church history. The norm for, I think, for many years was, you know, rare. It, you know, you might receive, I mean, you go right back, you might receive the Eucharist once in your life, I think it was, but, or, you know, once or twice in your life. And there were people who I know would, I remember reading one thing that people would save up until almost like their deathbed to receive communion, like receive all the sacraments right at the end and kind of, you know, to try and save it to the last. That is a risky behavior. But the idea of receiving Eucharist regularly and frequently, like, you know, weekly or daily, as we're blessed to be able to do in this part of the world, is still a, you know, a foreign concept in many other parts of the world. But what do you so what do you make of this, and what do you make of the discussions around celibacy and the priesthood?
Yeah, I feel sometimes it's the way in which we look at receiving the sacraments. So it's a privilege to receive them. We need them, like we need them in order to get along, you know, in our relationship with Christ. But we don't have a right to them, and I think that's got to come into it. I mean, I don't want to deny anyone the Eucharist at all, but you know, we have a history, and even a very, you know, in our own countries where the Eucharist hasn't always been readily available, and it takes time for those countries to build up, well, for the Catholic Church to sort of make her way into those countries in a way in which people can have access to the sacraments on a regular basis. We're used to it because in our lifetimes we've always had it, but 200 years ago in Australia they didn't, you know, and they had the Blessed Sacrament, and they didn't have a priest. Last year we went to a mass celebrating the, what was it?
The 200th anniversary of the reservation of the Blessed Sacrament.
So 200 years ago, they had no Catholic priest. All they had was, a Catholic priest brought the, had come, and then he was booted out. And so he left the Blessed Sacrament, but that's all they had until the next Catholic priest came. And we're talking about in a land as big as Australia. So it takes time for the Catholic Church to enter into places. Now, I think we should have a focus on, like, once we sort of expand into various countries and establish ourselves there, we then, you know, where else does the Catholic Church need to go? And who else needs to hear about Christ? And that's what we should be doing. Now, so the Amazon is a area of the world that is in need of more missionary work there. And I was actually just thinking about reflecting on it today, and I'm not sure if this is sort of in the same ballpark, but I was reminded of when, what's the story when, some of the Jews said to Jesus something like about, you know, or maybe Jesus said that divorce wasn't, you know, something from God, you know, and, you know, the Jews were like, well, you know, it's in our law that we're allowed to divorce our wife in certain circumstances or whatever. And Jesus said, well, that's because Moses wrote that in because you were so
hard of heart.
Yeah. And I'm like, have we actually got an opportunity to go, right, well, this is while it's not a dogma, but this is our practice,
our discipline,
and it's a discipline we want to maintain. So how, if we maintain this discipline, how then do we continue to do, like, to keep expanding and to keep sharing the gospel with others? And like, I thought his comment on, you know, the indigenous people don't understand our celibacy. Well, that's okay. They don't have to understand it. If you go there and you're a heroic witness to the priesthood and being a holy man and all that kind of stuff, and to how living the life with Christ in this particular way is, you know, a really fruitful and wonderful thing, then, like, people see, when they see something good, you know, like, they can recognize it.
We're not a pluralistic religion. It's not like we have to basically take our religion down to their lowest common denominator and try to please them. And that's what we're trying to do with secularism. It's just ridiculous across the board.
There must be other groups of peoples who've thought at some stage, oh, this is weird, this celibacy thing. But that's probably my personality as well. But I would like to keep the status quo. But we need to be more, we need to send more people there. And maybe once you get one or two local vocations to the priesthood, you know, maybe then the idea of celibacy becomes something revered in their culture too, you know. Because culture isn't a static thing, it changes and develops over time. So, and in fact, when you bring Christ into your culture, it will change as well. So, we're not really talking about it this time round, but perhaps next time round we should look at the other aspects that the synod is looking at, like about ecology and culture and how the church is interacting with those things, because I'm concerned about those perhaps more than the married priesthood. But
there's a good 2 cents adjusted for inflation. I think it's something which, you know, given the tapestry and the history around this issue, I think it is something that is, you know, complex and complicated. I think for various reasons, we have talked about it many times over the last decade on the 15th station, because of its, it's not going away as something which people ask questions about. For me, it's when it's connected to solving a problem around, oh, we'd have more priests if you could have, you know, married men could be priests. Maybe. You know, but I don't know if that's...
Nominations would probably counter that with we're not overflowing with priests or ministers.
And I ultimately, God calls people to the priesthood.
Yes.
So he will call people to the priesthood, whether we have a married priesthood or a celibate priesthood. And so I feel that in this experience, like in our sort of, oh, we haven't got enough priests to do our work, we just have to keep asking the Lord for more. And we have to keep praying and being a church where helps young men and middle-aged men as well, they don't have to be young, to choose this. And, you know, and they are choosing it. So, you know, we just need to keep, it's not solely our work. We have to cooperate with Christ, right? So Christ is the one who calls, and we just cooperate with that.
That's a really good point.
I feel like they've left Christ behind in this whole discussion.
It does feel very much like humans trying to solve a problem which isn't entirely something for us to solve. And I think, as we've talked about in the past, when it comes to married priests in general, like in everyday life, as speaking to other Christian denominations, which the church has done over years, the advice from others was don't do it. And I've always found it something where it's like having a split vocation would be very, I don't know. I've always struggled with the logistics of it, and that's looking at it with very Western eyes at the point where you're having to weigh up between, you know, it's not a job being a priest. It's a vocation, and it's not a job being married. It's a vocation, and having both those at the same time can be quite challenging. I mean, I guess ultimately what we've all got is a vocation to, you know, live for and love God, and these are the applications of that vocation, which can change over time, sure, but it's complicated. Well, and I mean, to your point, Anna, there's a lot of other stuff being discussed at the Synod, and I have a feeling we'll probably be talking about that in future episodes as well. Let's move on to back home here. This is from News Hub. A pro-life group is lashing out at the Select Committee for proposed abortion law changes after it agreed to see 150 out of 2,890 proposed oral submitters. Right to Life spokesperson Ken Orr said there is no urgency to pass the proposed abortion legislation bill and is urging the Abortion Legislation Select Committee to hear from more submitters. Quote, there is no urgency to pass this bill. There is, however, urgency for the committee to ensure that every citizen who wants to be heard is heard, both those for and against. but the committee's chair, Labour MP Ruth Dyson, told NewsHub, "There is nothing unusual in the number of oral submitters the group has invited to see. Quote, we receive and read all submissions we have. It's entirely up to the committee. We ensured that a range of perspectives were heard and Right to Life were an organisation we chose to invite." Right to Life lashed out after the committee announced this week it had received more than 25,000 submissions on the legislation, with about 2,890 submitters wanting to make an oral submission. The committee said it invited about 150 submitters to make an oral submission, about 5%, including legal experts, medical professionals, faith-based organisations, national bodies and individuals. "We appreciate the time and effort spent on written submissions," Dyson said. "These submissions will all be read and will inform our consideration of the bill." Orr said because the committee has no other business, it should devote itself to hearing from a wide range of people on their views and engaging in a respectful and open discussion. Well, Gavin, hey, for a start, okay, some interesting numbers, just to restate them because I was reading a lot of them there. 25,000 submissions on the legislation, 2,890, so nearly 3,000 of the 25,000 said they were keen to appear before the committee. For those international listeners, this is the way politics works, can work in New Zealand with our parliamentary system. So anyone was invited to submit against submit for or against the legislation and point out the things they wanted to, and then they're asked as part of that submission, as I was when I made mine, do you want to appear in person to discuss it and to give more colour to it? I've been watching some of the coverage of it. I don't know if you have, Gavin, of the 150 that are presenting. They get a grand total of 10 minutes to add some extra colour to what is. I mean, let's be honest, right? Even if we park for a moment the Catholic perspective on this and just look at it purely in terms of what it is as a quote-unquote health issue that involves the life and death of people, yeah? I think everyone has to accept those terms. Does this feel a bit... I'm trying not to make this a loaded question, but I'll just embrace it. 150 out of 25,000, mate? Like, what do you think that's adequate? Do you think that this is the committee should be doing... something more than 150?
Well, I think I know what answer you'd like me to give.
No, I'm genuine because you might tell me.
I mean, the nature of parliamentary and political process is that there is never the number of people who wish to give an oral submission who are invited to do so. My question, and it is a question because I don't know the answer, is how representative the sample is. Because as I understand it, the vast majority of submissions were against decriminalising abortion, which is what the committee is considering, or what the parliament is considering and the committee is investigating, essentially taking abortion out of the Crimes Act and decriminalising it and making it solely a health issue. If most of the submissions were against, is that being reflected in those who are being invited to give oral submissions? At some point, just looking at it pragmatically, if 75% of people hold a very similar view on a particular issue, is there value in having huge numbers of them come in and say exactly the same, more or less the same thing? Now, we can say that, well, from a democratic perspective, well, that's how it should work. But looking at it, you know, pretty objectively, as a parliamentary process, taking the issue out of it, I mean, this is how parliamentary process works. But all perspectives ought to be considered. And I'd like to be confident that that's happening, and I'm not sure that I can be. Right. So I suspect that I share a gripe with Ken Orr, who you've quoted, but I suspect it might be coming from a slightly different perspective.
I mean, it's fair. That's a fair point in terms of, you know, if they actually do read all the submissions and some of them are repeating the same point, we don't know whether or not the 150 is entirely representative, because the committee has, you know, plenary power to basically choose who they want to call in, I guess. But Anna, what about the general timeline in general? Like that you know, Ken's saying that there's no urgency to pass this bill, but the committee seems to be operating almost like there is. Like they want to have a smaller subset, and they, you know, their opinions may be already formed. Is kind of the implication. I mean, what do you sort of make of that?
Oh, look, I would, even going on the first reading, the vote was not, it didn't match what the submissions, were. So, it was it 94 to 23 or something that
history
the first reading?
Yeah, history would suggest that first readings aren't a great
But that's a massive...
Isn't the whole thing often you hear people who say I'm voting for it to go through to select committee so that we can examine this in more detail, but then when you're going through a really rapid, like there were some comparisons I saw in another article talking about this compared to the end of life choice bill, the euthanasia bill, and the same sex marriage bill, which are obviously both moral issues which usually people are perceiving religious people have a position on, and the pace with which this is being progressed just blew my mind.
It was interesting, actually. I was reading something that compared the euthanasia bill to this one in the sense of how many people wanted to give an oral submission and how many, like the percentage of those people that were given a go with the euthanasia bill. And so they're saying that with the euthanasia bill, heaps more people got a chance to do an oral submission as well. Now that was different because they put it through a health committee first, that hasn't sort of been rushed through as this one is. But still, like they're on similar kind of topics, and where there's a high emotional buy-in from all sides, and that committee saw fit to hear from more people. I don't particularly trust that this committee hasn't already decided what they want to suggest to the government. So,
Don, what do you make of this, mate? What do you make of the numbers and the stats and the general sort of approach?
I agree with Gavin. If you look at Facebook, there was a petition to basically make a submission to the select committee, and there was a cut and paste option that you could basically cut and paste a letter and send that through. So I don't know how many people partook in that, but I suspect that there will be, of those submissions, a fair few that said exactly the same thing verbatim. So to Gavin's point, it was always going to be less.
What I would hope with that is that there probably were people who were, and this is, there's nothing illegitimate about it, but people who were, encouraging others to submit and possibly providing them with some sort of words to include in their submission. I wouldn't want the 59th person who cut and pasted it to be the person that's chosen to go in front of the select committee, but it's the person who actually understands the issue from a legal perspective and understands legislation, rather than saying, we're going to pick, Mary Jones or Tom Smith from wherever to come and present to the select committee because he provided the same perspective as someone else who we might know, one of our friends, for example, who's very knowledgeable in this area and could provide a very thorough and rational presentation to the committee, that I hope they're not trying to sort of stack the deck skepticism.
True, but I think that in terms of, again, just because there's the two components to it, right? 25,000 people can submit, and there'll be a portion of those, that I'm sure it's copy and paste. And I've always discouraged that. Like, I think it's better, like this time around, I saw more of the sort of guides on how to submit, which wasn't just copy and paste this, because then that is bulk, classify them. So you're better to take it and put it in your own words. But of that, like a much smaller portion, 10%, basically said, I'm keen to come speak to it. And so you would think that if you were just a copy and paste submitter, you might not be the one going, I'll go and front it in person. Those who were fronting, and the ones I was watching, it was pretty compelling testimony. Like these were, from people from all walks of life. So to give the committee credit, they weren't just sort of taking on, the ones that I saw anyway, they weren't just taking in, one sort of style of person, very, very different experience. really great to see a number of the pro-life organisations in New Zealand and Crisis Pregnancy and others being represented. I thought the 10 minutes, like, you know, I'm looking at it from a corporate perspective and going, you know, oh gosh, it's a long day and you have to listen to people and you have to do all the reading. Are all 25,000 really going to be read? And I get all that. But this is life and death stuff. Like, you know, I make the joke in business all the time that we're not, you know, saving lives here. But these people actually are. So I kind of sit there and go, if you're going to spend time, if there's an issue to spend time on, this would be it, I guess. But hey, I guess you can get from the sense of my the tone of my voice what my submission said.
Well, maybe you didn't listen to the Prime Minister's passionate speech on this issue, where she basically used an example of a person who was trying to get an abortion and the bureaucracy that she had to go through to get that abortion. And I'm kind of like, what? Your sob story is basically the bureaucracy before a mother went to kill her child? That's your sob story? Seriously?
Yeah, I mean, there was a number of just to add more fuel to that, on the submissions I was watching, I only watched about an hour of them, but the submissions I was watching, that was the predominant argument of at least one of the members of the committee. I'm not sure. I don't know who the lady is. She's not. I know she's not the MP. Not Ruth Dyson, but her angle kept being. But what if we could make this earlier and it could be more of a not a medical abortion. What's the one where it's you know, taking a drug-induced abortion? What if it was at 4 weeks? What if it's 5 weeks? You know, would that deal with your thing? And then we could deal with the inconvenience factor. And we're talking about rural New Zealand and how they have to travel and how they have to jump through all these hoops. And
the travel, I have to see two people before I kill my child. Oh,
like, I mean, if you put the context in the ending of life under pretty much any other situation, we would be saying, I mean, as was being said on old Philip Seymour's thing, Philip Seymour, on the end of life choice bill, it's like, we need more safeguards. More safeguards, make sure that everyone's not forced to be, you know, put more bureaucracy around it. And here we're going, it's a little bit too bureaucratic.
Hey, it's going to be very hard. If I get to the oral submission stage, it's going to be very hard for me to be respectful.
If you would know if you've been selected, wouldn't you?
I don't know.
It sounds like it.
Some friends of mine have already got the decline, you're not selected letter, but I haven't got anything. So, yeah.
Oh, maybe I'll tell you what. Email address on. David,
it's podcast before they decide.
Yeah, and if they if you do get accepted, let me know, please, because I want to buy tickets for that. David Seymour, not Philip Seymour. I was trying to think who it was. Philip Seymour Hoffman is a actor. David Seymour is a
dead actor.
Yes, a late actor. Apologies.
And maybe that is under urgency because, God willing, the abortion-hungry Green Labour Alliance will be over in a year. So maybe that's the urgency.
Well, I think the one thing I would say that what definitely is urgent is for everyone to be praying and to be talking to their members of parliament and anywhere in New Zealand. If you're listening to this or you've got friends that you can talk to, like, seriously, this is an opportunity to storm for the voices of the unborn, I think. Right, our final story. This is from Fox 4 News, that well-established bastion of journalism. An Ohio church used its message sign to condemn the actions of a thief who stole a brand new air conditioning unit from the grounds. The incident happened about 3 years ago at Akron, 3 weeks ago, sorry, at Akron Alliance Fellowship Church. Pastor Gus Brown, see, that's a name I can pronounce, told Fox affiliate Fox 8 Cleveland. So this is from Fox 4 News, but it's actually being interviewed from Fox 8 in Cleveland, the Ocho. Brown said that the unit was $3,500. The organization also notified police of the theft. Quote, it was a brand new unit that we had just put in. We hadn't even made the first payment on it yet. It had only been a few days, he told Fox 8 Cleveland. Until the thief is found, the church shared a message on its welcome sign. Quote, whoever stole our AC unit, keep it. It's hot where you're going. The pastor told Fox 8 that Bible study classes and other church services will continue despite warm weather conditions. The church will have an offering plate on Sunday to raise money for a new air conditioner. That's a use of a church sign. Is that where you're going?
We've had church sign stories in our history.
We have.
So this is the latest, you know.
Fair enough, Gavin. I'm not going to knock it, but it's quite judgmental of this pastor.
Yeah. Well, I did wonder about that.
Yeah. Judge not lest you be judged. I'd say Gus. Come on, Gus. But at the same time, who nicks an air conditioning unit? Like, that's a bit off.
I mean, it's probably something that's fixed, you know, like, you know, be quite a reasonable undertaking to take it, right? So
Yeah. I mean, and also, if you're putting in a unit like that, do you want to spend a couple hundred bucks on some security cameras? You shouldn't have to be honest, but a bit of a low life for it. If you're listening to this podcast, you know, return the air conditioning, man. Come on, don't steal from a church. That's not cool. Don't steal. I'm pretty sure someone wrote that on a stone tablet at some point.
Not Gus.
Do we know that hell is climate-wise hot? Like, we know it's separation from God, but is it actually hot?
Well, I think of the story of the rich man and Lazarus, and didn't he say that he asked him to go quench his tongue because he was burning in fire?
Yeah. Okay, well, that would be hot then.
Yeah.
Well, it's gonna get hot in New Zealand and Australia soon too.
Yeah, but I have to say that I don't think that even if hell is physically hot, you don't get to take things with you, so... Yes, I get it. It's very funny. Well done, Pastor Gus Brown. I do hope you get your air conditioning unit back. But at the same time, don't play too much into the stereotypes about, you know, certain pastors who like to cast judgment and fire and brimstone and the like.
Maybe it was for his, like, great-grandmother who is incredibly hot and basically on her last month of life, and she wanted her to be very comfortable.
The Jean Valjean defense.
If you want more classic...
I doubt it, but...
Yeah, if you want more classic Broadway references, go and see how many more there were on in the podcast over the years. Go check out www.station15.co.nz for all of our previous episodes. I don't know if there are many more... have we got any Les Mis quotes? I don't know, actually. We have to go through and have a look. That might be a first. If subscribe, go subscribe. You can click the little subscribe button, or you can find us wherever good podcasts are found. Just search for the 15th Station, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. We're available wherever good podcasts are found. We should be there. If you want to reach out to us, we'd love to hear from you. feedback@station15.co.nz or twitter.com/station15 or facebook.com/station15. Thanks very much, Anna. It's always lovely to talk to you.
That's fine. Thanks for having me back.
Oh, our pleasure. Wouldn't be a podcast without you. Wouldn't be a podcast without the Don. Thanks, Don.
Thank you. And just as another plug, Gavin's going to do a musical number in the next episode.
Yeah, there you go. Tune in. Tell your friends to listen to a stirring rendition from the one and only Gavin. Thanks very much, mate. Thanks for organising and getting us together tonight.
Thanks, James. And I'll do some research on Dolce.
Yes, you will. I want to see your report on my desk before the next episode. We were slightly
tardy. Isn't that an espresso?
Well, we were slightly tardy this month, and we apologise for being a day or so late. But at least we've come to you. It's still the 15th station. We're not changing the number. But we hope wherever you are, you're in a good place. And we look forward to talking to you next time. And until then, take care and God bless.
This production is affiliated with SQPN, the StarQuest Production Network, leading the way.